Keeping it local. Cambridge 105.
What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I am Matt Bentman. We have no Ruth Reyes today, but we do have an Alan Alder.
Yes, we do. And also on the programme today, two Cambridge food festivals, yes, two. A great new way to get food from Cambridge Independence, plus wine, sausage rolls, bread, and we visit an old established Cambridge eatery.
It's not easy, is it, to get food from the Independence? King Street for afternoon teas is great cakes, up to Urban Larder in Mill Road for some of Jack's gelato, in the summer months only, of course, and over to Shelford Deli for all sorts. If only you could get everything from the same place. Well, that's where Trumpington Food Collective is going to be good. Here's co-founder Nazima Pathan talking with Alan recently about what it is, where it is, and when it will be.
So it's a movement, a food movement in the new developments on the south side of Cambridge. Along Adam Brooks Road and up leading up to Long Road, there are thousands of new homes and lots of people moving in, from busy young professionals to families to retired people wanting to move into sort of more modern homes. And there needs to be a sense of community. At the moment, there is no community hub. There is the plan to build that, and it'll start to be open from next year. All the new infrastructure is going to be there. But what we want is to make sure that within that there isn't just the usual brand, big high street brands. We want our local food suppliers to have an opportunity to sell to a population that really is enthusiastic about good food. And to test that out, you know, we've engaged with the community and with suppliers, and everybody seems excited about the opportunity if we can set up a way for people to buy local food, locally produced, good quality food in a format that's convenient for suppliers and for buyers. So what we want to do to start with, I mean, in the long run, we would love a physical space where we could showcase food, you make food, you know, in a cafe and with a kitchen, where we'd ideally like to have a kitchen where people could cook and learn to cook, particularly, you know, young mums with kids, and, you know, make classes affordable so that this is something that's for the whole community, not being, you know, sort of any kind of expensive place to learn to cook, but just to be a nice community kitchen. But on the sort of supplier side, what we'd like is to have the best local producers available to supply food to other community. To start with, we need to build a momentum. So at the moment, what we're doing is we're going to do it through an online format. And essentially, it's like a farmer's market where people will be able to shop across all the producers on a website called TrumpingtonFoodCollective.com. And they will then put things into their basket, and just as it would with any online food shopping experience. And then all the suppliers are going to deliver to us on a Thursday morning, and we will then collate them into packages with each person's individual orders, maintain things at the right temperature, and then people can come pick up on the pickup window, which will probably cover from preschool time for mums to pick up before they collect their children through till early evening for people who are at work. So we're kind of trying to make this sort of advantageous for everybody and easy so that people take up this offer. And that's our plan. And we've been bowled over by the sort of support, actually, of all the local producers who appreciate that to start with, this is going to be, going to have to gain momentum, but they want to work with us and supply us. It's for them, you know, it's a supply to order, but they do need to bring the stuff to us. We don't have the infrastructure to collect. But we've got some great brands, you know, we've got bread from Cobb's Bakery and Dovecote Bakery going to supply us. We've got Cam Cattle and Mill Road Butcher. We've got a fantastic fruit and veg supplier out in Papworth called Kale and Damson, who does a lot of the big catering and colleges supplying. And some other organic farms as well around Cambridge. We have got fantastic ice cream from the Jack's Gelato. He came yesterday to our little engagement event, and everyone was, you know, really delighted to taste his amazing ice cream. There's a new patisserie guy called Dulcedo. He's a chef as well, pastry chef, Andrew, and his chocolates and macarons were amazing. And he's going to be selling through us, as well as the lovely Corinne from Gourmandise. And she's going to supply her lovely little tarts, her passion fruit tarts, which I think have won a Great Taste Award, which are incredible, were really popular. And another lovely person I've discovered is Alison Lucis from Aldi's Baltic Bakes, whose pierogies are incredibly good. And she makes them in different flavours, with local ingredients. It's been the wonderful thing about it is just discovering how many really good makers of food there are locally. And, you know, it's not, we're not just, selling local food because it's locally produced. Really, this stuff is really nice. So I hope people will see that. And that's what we wanted people to taste yesterday. So we had this event yesterday, and people love the food and are very keen and are signing up to find out when the shop will open.
And when will this open?
Well, I'm working with Kelly from Rubber Cheese on the site, and hopefully that will be in about 4 to 6 weeks' time.
Right. Okay, well, let us know.
Yeah, thank you. We'll probably have a launch event, so I'm sure we'll be trying to get everybody along.
But you've got some great names there, some great producers, some of the best.
Yes, exactly. The best food. Because we've been writing our blog and been part of the Cambridge food scene for a while, so we kind of already had an idea of who we'd like to work with. But more and more names from everybody we spoke to, from people in the, you know, like Vari and Pina from 1-2 Culinary Stew, and Vari Russell from the food marketing expert, you know, gave us names of all kinds of amazing people. So the more we've gone out there, and as we get bigger, you know, we want to work with all of them. This, at the moment, we're trying to get the core things. You know, everybody needs bread, meat, and flour. So we've got Pryor's Farm flour as well. So all the usual staples and fruit and veg, and then we can expand outwards once we start to have some more capacity and demand.
Yeah, so it's like a food assembly, except that the producers aren't actually there at the time.
That's right. It's going to be, I suppose, that's to start. Our ultimate aim is for it to have a physical site. And what we want is for the website will always remain, and we want it to be a site of inspiration. So we're going to have recipes, videos, meet the suppliers, and, you know, seasonal inspiration newsletters. So what we hope is to get inspired by the ingredients, particularly to cook using local ingredients.
Well, that sounds excellent.
Good.
Brilliant. Okay, thanks very much.
Nazima Pathan from the Trumpington Food Collective, which is planning to open at the end of May. That's excellent news for people who live in Trumpington or who just drive past on their way home from work.
Yeah, and they've got some really good suppliers too, I think, and there are more names being added as well. So it should be a success, and you can sign up for emails telling you when it's opening and who's going to be there at their website, trumpingtonfoodcollective.com.
But I hear that the Cambridge Food Assembly is closed, yeah?
Oh, yes, it is. Rich Widows, who started it up, has left Cambridge. And he had a team, there were two other people there, but it's just not enough to keep it going. So they're looking for somebody to help them, really. So if anybody is interested, they should email or tweet them. 750 people were signed up, so, you know, it's a goer.
Yeah, it's very popular, eh?
Yeah.
On to our next feature now. When you head off to Market Square and you wander down Rose Crescent, you see what looks like a shop with a little green awning. You can't miss it because it belongs to Gardenia, and that's a restaurant diner. An eatery has been on that site for the last 100 years, and here is a feature about it.
Teach me to dance, will you?
Did you say dance? Come on, my boy.
Being a hospitality business, first of all, you have to love people. And you have to love when you make people happy. And this is philosophy of life, basically. When you love people, you do everything to make them happy. So I'm going to create a menu and an atmosphere like a fairy tale, optimistic. My name is Vasilios Anastasiou. I come from Greece. I came in Gardenia roughly 30 years ago. My place is in Rose Crescent. A lot of people call it Gardis. I could say it's a Greek restaurant, but it's international restaurant with all the tastes.
Yeah.
Of course, Gardenia is a very, very old place. That's why I'm fascinated with all things and antiques and all that. Gardenia started about 1902 or 1910. It used to be in double N. Mm-hmm. People used to have their horses outside and they used to come here to have soups. Few families since then changed up to 1990. Mm-hmm. Up to this time, Gardenia was an expensive restaurant for fellows and rich students. And it didn't accommodate local people because it was very expensive. For example, chicken souvlaki these days with sauce and salad, everything, is $4.90. 1990, this chicken souvlaki was $5.70.
Yeah.
And you didn't get salad and you didn't get sauce. You have to purchase them separately. Particularly these days, a lot of people don't have enough money. So here we, with our punters, they know the deal. Like, I have that much money, what can I have? You can have that. And always we try with people who say things like this, we try to be a little bit more generous so we don't disappoint them because life is like that.
Lamb souvlaki, Gardenia spicy special, special veg burger with feta cheese, tzatziki, salad, tomatoes, and a lot more.
I just came in for some fish and chips, actually.
Gardenia was available. I was working here part-time. Mm-hmm. When became available, actually, when McDonald's opened, proprietor of Gardenia, he was like shaking, like he's not going to have business. So I jumped in. I asked my family to give me the money, you know, we were Greeks, so everybody have some money aside from the children. So I asked my dad to give me a family to start this place. And he gave me the money. He was a little bit upset because he said to me, after private schools and high education, you're going to open a restaurant sort of thing. I told him that there's no restaurant, it's a place in Cambridge, it's a place next to universities. I like it, I feel good here. Meet a lot of people in Cambridge because it's multicultural society,
yeah.
It's a cosmopolitan place. Next to universities, I will have access to libraries and books, which I always dream about it. So that would happen. When I come here, about 1990, I create an environment for everybody. I open the door so local people can afford the food and feel like a local shop. This is my shop. And that's what I want. I want people to come here and feel comfortable, sit in the restaurant if they have time. Because they will go by, take away.
Rebecca, you're new here, but you said this is already your second time at Gardenia.
Yes, my second time this week, in fact. The first time was a couple days ago, and I loved it so much, I thought I might come back and try something different.
What is it about it that you love?
The ingredients seem really fresh, and so that's really nice. And the music, the atmosphere here is fun. And the first time I came, I had takeaway, so I went and I sat by the river and I ate my falafels, and that was nice. But now I'm sitting here with my food and my book, and it's a great place just to sit and to read.
I believe food is not just a nutrition thing for humans to eat in order to survive. Food is a magic of life. So in Gardenia we introduce, like, we have more herbs and spices than any other restaurant. They're not cheap, they're expensive. By mixing them and put them in the right order, the food will not be your enemy after you eat it. You will digest it easily, get the nutrition, and it will give you something extra by putting all the herbs. Because food is a chemistry, basically. Mm. It's like our body. If you talk with a lot of people, Europeans or worldwide, they say England, it doesn't have a good cuisine. They're so wrong. I believe, personally, in England, you found things you cannot find nowhere else. I come from a town called Levadia, which is the most famous town in Greece for the souvlaki. Mm. My souvlaki is much better because I'm in England. And I do say to the people, this is the souvlaki of the future. You are behind. It is much better because I have the ingredient, I have the space to make it better here. Because England have whatever herbs you want, whatever you want, you can find in England. And that's the beauty of it. So everything been created here. We cannot say it's English. It's multicultural, cosmopolitan. It's magic. That's why England should have a name. England, I think, can accommodate all the cultures. I don't think is any other place in the world can do the same. It's like your mom, you go home, she puts food on the table. Regardless, you know, she puts so much love on that food, which the food is good. That's why we all missing our mom's food in the end of the day, regardless if we go to the most expensive restaurant in the world. Because if you go to the most expensive restaurant, it doesn't have the love. Our food is no, I cannot say it's Greek, I cannot say it's Mediterranean, is English. I would say it's just food. which is a unique menu I created myself from traveling around the world, and I pick up tastes, and I speak to the chefs, and I write everything down with the things I like.
So you've spent more than half your life in Cambridge?
Absolutely, yeah. In Cambridge, in Gardinia, I can say. I spent a lot of time here because, I don't know, I've always felt comfortable here. That's why I'm here. I felt comfortable. It's a good energy.
We've come to Gardinia for our evening meal with my wife. Mm-hmm. You know, we've thoroughly enjoyed our meal. What are your thoughts of it then, June?
Hello, I'm June West, and yes, I really enjoyed my dinner. Nice fish, lovely chips, with a slice of lemon on the side.
Yeah.
Couldn't be better.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Definitely come again.
Yes, yeah.
So what did you order today?
Fish and chips, actually, very traditional. English. Yeah, English. Yeah, it was really crispy.
Have you always come for the fish and chips, or have you ever tried some of the more Greek dishes?
No, we're boring. We've just come for the fish and chips.
Typical English people. But
yeah.
Sometimes my customers say to me, you know, ooh, why Greek burger is $3.90 and the cheeseburger is $3.30? I said, for the ingredients you have inside. But I say to them, don't be foolish. You cannot pay for the ingredients. The ingredients are free. You only pay for the service. Because if you think how many billions of years of evolution it took to create bread or wheat, and you put time and margin profits, no way you can afford bread, mate. Doesn't matter who you are. Even if you are the most rich person, even if you are Bill Gates, you cannot afford one sesame seed if you put time, evolution, and how many billions of years. So you pay for the service. You cannot afford food. Food is from God, from nature. So be respectful of food. Don't think because it's not so expensive, it doesn't worth nothing. It's worth everything. And because you cannot afford it, you have it for free. You just pay for the service. For the electricity, the rates, and for them. You do not pay for the food. Nobody can pay for my food. My food is free.
What keeps you coming back?
Well, it's a nice atmosphere, good prices, good food. Everything you can ask for, really, yeah.
This is my fourth time or fifth time. I got the recommendation from a friend because I was looking for a place for kebab. I really like kebab, and he told me, like, this is the best place for kebab in town for the best price.
So if somebody have the time to look at the menu, he will find exactly what he wants. And he doesn't have to be like from the menu. People come, punters here, they say, oh, Vash, can I have a little bit of lamb, a little bit of chicken, a couple of falafels, you know, slice of feta. I say, okay, because like we're going to get confused. I say, you tell me how much you want to spend and I choose the quantity.
Okay.
And that's fair. And when I show you the quantity, if you don't like, I'm going to put something extra, whatever you like, because you're going to be satisfied. I never had anybody complaining. So people come here and say, I want meze, but I only have 6 pounds. I said, fair enough, so what? It's okay. Or a lot of children come and say, chips is 170, I only have 50 pence. I say, I'm going to give you chips for 50 pence. Oh, I say, okay. I mean, if you are friendly to people, they open up. They are not embarrassed once they know you. Because always, like, I'm a bit softy with people who in need.
You said 30 years in the business, 26 years as Gardenia, and I guess you've seen generations of people who've grown up here, families who've come back. I guess you're familiar with those people as well.
Absolutely. I saw the people now is like three different... Like, I have served the grandfather, the son, and the grandson.
Yeah.
And sometimes... They come all together. It's so lovely because a 10-year-old child, he goes to the counter a little bit, he says, Vash, Greek sausages with tzatziki, no salad, nothing. Like, it is funny because the whole family laughs how a child 10 years old. But this child is coming here from 5, and his grandfather is coming here for the last 30 years. And his son, he was coming here nights because I see these people, you know, and we have a lot of people which they have marked, after they finish university, they have marked, like, after 15 years, we're going to be in Gardinia.
Yeah.
And, like, we had a wedding. Some post-doctors got married in Trinity University. And we had order for 200 special burgers because the wife of the man, she always had, for 4 years she was in Germany, she had special burger. And she wanted everybody to test what is special burger, so we have to give 200 special burgers, which was quite funny, sort of thing. You know, they had all the money in the world, but she wanted special burger. They had silver service and everything, black suits and ties. It was, whoa, you know, it was scary for us. And I love every bit of it. I mean, it's not about money. Of course, money is necessity and everybody have to make money to pay the bills. But fair enough, you have to have a higher purpose. Whatever you do, whatever job you do, you have to have a higher purpose. You have to love it. If you don't love it, get out of it.
I like to come at midday because many people associate the restaurant with late night food and not so much with midday food.
But doesn't matter if it's night or if it's morning, you know, for us it's the same thing.
But it's also good for having lunch. And there's always space, rather than there's only six tables, but I always find space.
And so it's, for me, it was an international recommendation if people from all over the world would come here and have food together. So that's what drew me to the Gardena.
We are Gardena. Oh, you shouldn't stop. Do it again.
On Rose
Crescent.
Yeah, okay.
That's right, it's a sort of place that you stick in the back of your mind for next time, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a good energy around here. Good energy, strong energy.
Okay. You're making me laugh when I look at you.
Okay, we are Gardenia, Greek restaurant on Rose Crescent. You did it, yeah?
That's Gardenia, basically. It's not much. But all the knowledge of all the years I gather in Athens, in little flea markets and old bookshops, I gather all the information. And as my dad say, you know, you like to be a cook. You are a cook.
And many thanks to Vas, his staff, their customers. Gardenia is open on 2 Rose Crescent, 7 days a week, 11 a.m. to 5 a.m. That's 18 hours every day. And their website is Gardis, GARDIS.co.uk.
Mandy Morton here to invite you into Mandy's Garden Shed this Saturday lunchtime. We'll be on the allotment, answering your gardening questions and peering over the hedge into a celebrity's garden. That's Saturday from 1 till 2, community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Eat Cambridge, the food and drink festival, starts next Saturday with The Big Event, and that takes place at the Corn Exchange in Wheeler Street, and there is an astonishing number of providers there. As usual, there's a series of talks as well, and one will be given by Rosie Sykes, development chef at Pint Shop, and here she is to give us an outline.
We are the first talk at 11 o'clock in the morning on the first day, which is a great honour, just to talk about the things that are really, really integral and important to Pint Shop, which is we strive to be able to use seasonal produce as much as we can and to keep that. But as I said before, that is quite difficult because the seasons are changing a lot. And with our menu, we keep the menu the same for 3 months. Sometimes we'll have a little break in the 3 months to change a couple of things because they've changed, the season's moved on a little bit, or the supply because of the weather hasn't been as great as it should have been. So we're lucky that we can look at those things all the time, but our menu is as seasonal as it possibly can be. So we're just changing the menu now, and that will stay until June, and we've got on it wild garlic.
Is wild garlic available in profusion? I mean, it's called wild. Do people actually grow it for culinary purposes?
They do a little bit, but the thing about it, you probably know yourself doing gardening, that if you plant some, it just takes off. So I think there are a lot of people who forage for it because it's everywhere if you know the right places to go. But again, it would grow incredibly easily. But I have to say, whenever you get it from the veg supplier, it's full of kind of undergrowth and all sorts of grasses and mud, and so I feel like it's much less kind of
adulterated chemically.
Yes, yeah, it feels very natural. We absolutely love it. We've done a croquette which has got kaffili cheese, spring onions and wild garlic in it. Croquettes have become a bit of a theme on the starter menu at Pint Shop because they're very popular. So we try to change them every season. So that's the new one. We will be putting asparagus on the menu, but as I said to you, I'm very vehement about the season, which starts on St. George's Day. So we'll be changing to asparagus in May on the menu. We've got some spring lamb, a Barnsley chop of spring lamb on the menu, and a couple of lovely rhubarb dishes. We've made a gin-cured mackerel. So there's a lot of exciting things coming up. And in our talk, we'll be talking about the things that we're able to do on, because we do work on a very large scale, which is part of the thing that I find very interesting and exciting about Pint Shop.
And well, I find Pint Shop a great place to go and eat. It's not terribly expensive. It's not as pricey, I think, as you might expect. Perhaps I shouldn't be saying this. Maybe they'll put their prices up now, but it's good value.
It is good value for what they do. I think it's definitely good value. And also they've got their set menu, which is, you know, really great value. And that's really important to them, is that it is a place that is accessible to many. And it's another thing that I really admire about them. All the staff are very involved in the menus. We have very big training sessions. So I've trained all the kitchen staff on the new menu, and next week we will train all the waiters. So we have about 3 hours where they sit and try all the food, and we give them a little quiz and we talk about everything. And that's a really, really nice thing. I ate there the other day with a friend, and she asked the waiter a lot of questions, and he was able to answer them all, which made me very proud.
Thanks to Rosie Sykes, who will be speaking at the big event next Saturday at 11 a.m. An impressive setup is Pint Shop, and they've just opened in Oxford as well.
The other talks at the big event are at 11:30, Artisan Cheesemakers. That's presented by the Gogmagog Farm Shop. At 12, Stephen Marsh from Pinkster Gin talks about, well, gin. At 2 p.m, Food and Waste in Cambridge with Alex Collis from Cambridge Food Cycle. And at 2:30, writer B. Wilson talks about her new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. And at 3:30, Tim Haywood has the last word. All of those are free for people attending the big event, and there's no booking.
And while we're talking about Eat Cambridge, don't forget to book for the debate. That takes place on the 15th of May from 3 to 5pm at the Debating Chamber in the Union Building behind the Round Church in Bridge Street, a fantastic venue for it. The title of the debate is Cambridge Food, Art or Science? And on the panel, Tim Haywood from Fitzbillies and the Financial Times, Alex Rushmer from Hole in the Wall, was a finalist on MasterChef a few years ago, Joe Kennedy from the Black Bar Brewery, Dr. Viva Kalnick-Hite from Dovetail to do printed fruit, Ben Aveling from the Radmore Farm Shop, and Dr. Mary-Ann Ha, director of East Anglia Foodlink, and in the chair, Dr. Sue Bailey, food scientist, and previously on this very programme. Mm.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
This Sunday and Monday is the Ely Food and Drink Festival on Palace Green in Ely. More about that in our news section at the end of the programme. And speaking of festivals, Thirsty on Chesterton Road are about to launch theirs. So here they are to tell us more.
Hello, my name is Carla, and we're talking about Thirsty Fest on June 4th.
Hi, my name is Katya, and I'm the external event organiser of Thirsty Fest.
Hi, and I'm Sam, and looking forward to bringing the whole Thirsty gospel over to Southern Cambridge at Bodyworks on Glisson Road on the 4th of June.
One bourbon, one scotch, and one bill.
It will hold up to around 1,000 people, so we're expecting a big crowd of people. We will split them up into two sessions, and we really want to bring the community together in a very, very new and exciting event, and more importantly,
lots of lovely drinks. We've got producers coming in from across Europe, wine producers from France, Spain, Italy, Germany, craft brewers from across the UK, possibly even from New Zealand, to be confirmed. Spirits producers as well. We've got Hot Numbers, our local coffee roasters.
Hey, Mr. Bartender,
see the people behind the bottle. I think that is a very big point about it as well. It's not being scared of the people behind the bottle, or never seeing them actually. And as Thirsty works mainly with small producers as well, it's just give the producer the possibility to actually meet their consumers in a way, which is not actually happening very, very often.
And if you had a chance to visit here Thirsty in the past couple of weeks, you've noticed some fantastic food trucks, which will also be showcased at Thirsty Fest, and you'll see some familiar faces.
And a bit of music too. Again, we want to do this differently, and you know, you mix up great drinks with great food, music. We're going to have John Wheeler from Hayseed Dixie rocking his Nashville finest.
Back in black, how it sang. Been gone too long, it's good to be back.
Displays from local artists from around Cambridge, and just really make it unlike any other event that Cambridge has had before, and take what we've tried to do here at the Thirsty Shop, supersize it, and leave Cambridge begging for more.
Yeah, and also there are still some spaces left for local businesses who want to actually join us on our little adventure. We want to show off what local businesses can do in Cambridge.
I think it was May 2 years ago where Cambridge had its first night market, Eat Cambridge Night Market.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite hidden away. But the volume of people that came along was staggering, I thought, and it could well be the same with this on Glisson Road. Do people need to book? Do they have to purchase tickets to attend?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they do indeed. You can find everything on Twitter, on our Facebook webpage, or on Thirsty Fest.
So we're also going to be running a series of fringe events around the main event. So all weekend from the 3rd to the 5th, there'll be tie-ups with local pubs, bars, restaurants. There'll be Meet the Brewer events, tap takeovers for the beer fans. There are going to be some food and wine matching setups with some of the leading local restaurants. So we just want, again, we want to take the event out beyond what we're doing in Glisson Road, beyond what we do in Chesterton Road, take it out right across the town. For information about Thirsty Fest, the best way is to go online. All tickets are sold billetto.co.uk/thirstyfest. That's billetto.co.uk/thirstyfest. Enjoy a nice drink, have a nice bite to eat, listen to the music.
And meet some new people.
Meet some more people, yeah.
Meet some more people out of the community.
If you're following us on social media, on Twitter and Thirsty's Facebook, we are constantly updating with everything, all the information needed about local food trucks, what's happening with Thirsty Fest. If you need information further, yeah, you could just take a peek online.
Or just come along to Thirsty Shop.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. All the people here at Thirsty.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
See you on the 4th.
So if the sound of Thirsty Fest takes your fancy, you can find out more information via Facebook. Just search for Thirsty Fest. That's all one word. And likewise on Twitter, @ThirstyFest. Or email, thirstyfest@gmail.com.
Lots of choice there. Right, we've got some time for some tweets. In fact, we've got time for one tweet now. It's from Novi in Regent Street. They have Allotment Cafe there today. And this evening, they've got River Kitchen. Tomorrow, Baked by Romano's, and on Monday from 4, the Kofco Cider launch, which should be rather nice.
Yeah. Now, Ruth Reyes has found a hot new food trader on Cambridge Market.
I'm here with Sarah Hughes of the Cambridge Scotch Egg Company. You're new to the market. You started a couple of weeks ago, didn't you?
Yeah, completely brand new business. Been a home cook for lots and lots of years, but first time really running any kind of catering business. Yeah, so, and it's going well. Yeah, really enjoying it.
It's
especially
good
when the sun shines, yeah.
So what kind of Scotch egg flavours do you do?
We call them gourmet. So we try to change up the flavours every day. We're trying to offer a gluten-free one, which is normally just a premium pork without many additives. Today we've got pork and chorizo. Just looking at our menu, we've got a smoked cheddar and fig. We've had pork and date. We do a vegetarian one. We've also had smoked haddock. There are so many varieties, just, you know, any flavour combination you can think of, we try and put it into a Scotch egg.
What's your most unusual flavour combination you've had so far?
I think, the smoked mackerel, we did dip with some capers. Which is, it's not really unusual. It's quite traditional to put capers with smoked mackerel, but it's quite unusual in a Scotch egg. So yeah, that was a little bit of a slow starter, but we sold out eventually of those, yeah, so that was lovely.
So how do you get the coating nice and crusty?
Well, we use, after lots of testing and lots of experimenting, we decided to go with panko breadcrumbs, which are like a fast-dried Japanese breadcrumb, just made from the centre part of the bread. They cut the crusts off and they just, I think it's dried, kiln dried or something, and it just makes for a really, really crunchy coating. And obviously the Japanese use it when they're deep frying prawns and chicken balls, and it's just fantastic for that. We get all of our day old bread from the man who runs the bread stall on the other side of the market. He gives us his bread because it's beautiful sourdough, so we let that dry out and then we crumb it down and we mix that with the panko, so we get that double, it's got that lovely flavour and then the crunchy of the panko.
How do you get the gluten-free version?
Well, we source all our sausage meat from Grasmere Farm, which is a very well-known farm that specialises in outdoor-reared organic pork. And they basically, we order it, they send us the gluten-free pork, which is just a pure pork with nothing in it. And because Lauren, who is my partner in this business, she works for the Cambridge Chop House, they're training her to be a chef. She made the contact with Grasmere Farm and they were happy to sell to us on the market. It was the first time for them, and it's a fantastic, beautiful sausage meat. Yeah, delicious.
Cool. So how do you keep the egg ready on the market?
They're boiled, soft boiled at home, and then plunged into freezing cold water, chilled down and kept overnight in the fridge, so they're really, really cold. And then immediately from the fridge, transported to the market in our cool box, which keeps it below a certain temperature. And then they're wrapped in the sausage meat here. And it's just all about the timings. If you get the timings right and keep the temperatures down, 8 minutes in the fryer and no more than perhaps 45 minutes to an hour in our little hop cabinet at quite a low temperature, they stay runny all day. Yeah. We did lots of testing, obviously. We ended up with, like, you know, dozens of hard-boiled eggs and dozens of ones you couldn't eat. And just over time, you just perfect that, keeping it crispy on the outside and runny on the middle.
Where do you get your eggs, actually? Are they anywhere from around here?
They are free-range from Love's Farm, who are a similar farm to Grasmere. All their chickens, because that was another thing we looked at first. We didn't want to use eggs that were from caged hens. We wanted a free-range egg that had a really nice bright yellow yolk, and to make sure that the chickens weren't caged and that they were genuinely free-range. So, yeah, utterly beautiful. And then if you get the consistency of the sizes and you've got your timings right, you know, 8 minutes, that would be a soft yolk. So Love's Farm and Grasmere.
Yeah. Have you noticed a popular flavour? Like, what's the one that's been going the most that you just can't get enough of?
Chorizo.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, as soon as I cooked those this morning, they're literally gone. They're either reserved or sold. So I should have made 20 or 30 today, and they would all have gone. Yeah. Some days, the black pudding is a big one. Depends if you get lots of rugby players down, they go for the black pudding. But yeah, without doubt, it's always chorizo that sells out first.
So where else can we find you other than on the market?
We've just won a bid to trade at Cambridge Live in the summer, so we'll be there for 3 days over the festival. And other than that, we're just here on the market at the moment.
Any specific days?
We're here Tuesday and Thursday are our licensed pitch day. And today we're trading as casual traders, but we've also got a Sunday this week. So as many days as we can get. Yeah.
So why did you decide to do Scotch eggs? Why Scotch eggs?
There's a beautiful farm called, it's called the Gog Magog Farm. And for years, the lady that runs the kitchen there has been making Scotch eggs, and she just makes a few and puts them on the counter. They're not soft-boiled, they're hard-boiled. And my son and I used to always go to the farm shop, and that would be the first place we'd head to get a Scotch egg, because they're just so delicious, you know? And I always wanted a catering business, and I just said to my son, I'm going to start a little market stall. What shall I sell? And he just said Scotch eggs. And I thought, yeah, let's go with that.
Really? Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, what a nice story. And what interesting flavours too. Smoked cheddar and fig. Pork and date sound great.
They do. And it's nice to know that great British traditions like black pudding are still going strong too.
Yeah, but is Cambridge becoming the Scotch egg capital of the country, you know? People I know who come and visit Cambridge can't do anything till they've had one from Pine Shop, and now they're spoiled for choice.
Ah, we are lucky. Alison McTaggart is better known by many as Bread on a Bike. She makes sourdough bread, a great variety of flavours, at home, and she delivers them to customers on her bike. She spoke to Alan about her bread last August, so let's listen again.
These are all sourdough, and they're a variety of kinds, so a white. This is probably about 80% wholemeal, but I call it a multi-seed. These are all what I would call special loaves. This one's an apple and oat. So it's got chunks of apple in it and quite a high percentage of oats. This one is a poppy and sesame seed loaf with quite a high percentage of seeds in it. This one is roast potato and rosemary, which is, it's a really tasty loaf, and that, you know, it is a favourite. I've got a variation of that, that, you know, when I need to make 70 of them, my recipe that I use is roast potato, I think, and cumin and chilli. Mm. Which is easier to do in big quantities, because otherwise it just takes hours and hours. It's something to eat with food, I think. That would go perfectly with an ottolenghi dish, which is something that I do quite a lot, I guess.
Yeah.
These ones are an experiment. These are 100% rye. I came across a recipe for a raisin borodinsky. So it's 100% rye, and the recipe had 30% of raisins, soaked raisins, mm-hmm. in it, mm-hmm. and coriander. If I'm developing a loaf for that I might sell, then, you know, you'll try out a recipe, try out a variation. This is a variation I did with less fruit, to see, and, you know, obviously we can cut into it and see what they look like and what they taste like. You need a loaf that will be appealing to customers. You know, this one to me is, it looks too dense, too small. A normal loaf would look a lot bigger and better and raised than that.
Mm.
And then these are the burger buns that I'm experimenting with. This is a recipe for brioche, really, or challah, which I'm using. So, I'll, you know, they've all got to be tasted and tested to see what they say, see what they look like.
Yeah.
But the ones on the top shelf, the first ones we described, are all ones that are on my normal list.
They're your regulars.
Yeah, they're my regulars.
Yeah, well, they do look good.
I was made redundant from my long-term job and had been making bread for a few people at work. So when I left work, they still wanted their bread. So I carried on baking at home and cycling it into work. And from there, really a few more friends started to want bread, and it built up just by word of mouth. I was really encouraged by the demand for it, by how much people did appreciate decent bread and want it. And maybe it was slightly quirky, you know, me cycling, making bread at home and cycling around with it. But eventually people sort of, you know, what are you called? What are you doing? So I had to come up with a name. And so the name was just Bread on a Bike, because that was what I was doing.
And I've looked on your website, you've done an extraordinary variety of breads.
It's all sourdough. It's because I'm working in my home kitchen. The most types of bread I could do to provide enough variety for people was four types. And each week, the four breads changes. So it might be the one I've made today, I call a 78. That's a particular type of dough, a white bread. And then there's another one which I call a Romsey Wild, which is a slightly different recipe, and it would have a different appearance, different slashing and that sort of thing. So I'm always experimenting with different types of bread. And people seem to like the novelty. You know, what will there be in the email this week? Will it be, you know, a different bread, I guess? I always make one whitish sourdough, one wholemeal sourdough, 100% rye, because there's lots of demand for that and can't get it anywhere else. And then there's a special, which can be anything. It's great fun to develop bread, and exciting to come up with different breads, to try different things. Every Thursday I send out an email to everybody on the list, and then they respond with what they would like for the following week. And then, of course, I've got this logistic nightmare of working out, you know, certainly as I got busier, working out how I would, how I deliver them, when I can deliver bread to these people and how I do that.
Right. And have you got many people you deliver to?
At the moment, I've got about 300 active customers.
That's incredible. All from a domestic kitchen.
Yes. I mean, the most I can make from my domestic kitchen is about 280 loaves. And that's baking Tuesday to Friday. So I'm baking 4 days, but obviously sourdough is a long fermentation process. So the sourdough for Tuesday morning starts on Sunday night.
Mm.
You know, with refreshing your leaven, making your dough on Monday, baking Tuesday, and then that cycle is continuing over the rest of the week.
Mm.
So it's a really full-time job.
Yes, and sourdough is not the easiest of breads to become expert at either. How did you develop your expertise?
I think it was in 2011. I decided that I wanted to know how to make sourdough. Sourdough seemed this elusive thing, you know, and books gave you different, you know, descriptions, you know, every time. So I couldn't quite make sense of it. So I decided to do a course. And I did a course with Andrew Whitley, who is the person who wrote Bread Matters. I did my sourdough course with Andrew Whitley and, of course, was totally inspired by that. Came back home and, of course, sourdough, you think you know what you're doing, but it isn't until you put the process into action that you realise that you don't know what you're doing. And so, of course, once you start, I just couldn't stop, because one loaf is good, but you want to try to change something. You know, you think you need to change something. You just keep on developing a process. So it's very much trial and error. In the meantime, I'd heard about this guy called Ben McKinnon in London, who had started in a sort of similar way, started making bread at home. He ended up starting the E5 Bakehouse in Hackney, and I'd heard about him and his story and been really inspired by that. And so I contacted him, said, well, can I come and volunteer here? I could come down each Saturday. So I started going down each Saturday and did that for 18 months period up to my redundancy.
So are you looking to expand your capacity then?
Well, what happened was that I'd been working really hard, you know, sort of 80, 90 hours a week, because which was great. It was I was just, you know, trying to meet the demand there was. But ultimately, at some point in June, my body started saying to me, you know, you can't carry on like this. I had to take a break for a while, just while I recovered from that. And of course, realised that I did need to take a break because I needed to address the next stage of the business.
Mm.
You know, I'd reached the limit of what I could produce in my home kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to find a sustainable way of doing that.
But finding alternative premises can't be easy.
No, I'm looking at all sorts of alternatives. I'm looking at expanding my kitchen. I'm looking at industrial units, possibly. But ideally, I want a retail unit, because the thing I want to do is to be in contact with people.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, I love making bread, but the brilliant thing about working at home is that people come and collect their bread, or I'm out delivering, so I'm seeing people, I'm getting the exercise as well, which is brilliant, getting out of my kitchen. And my plan for the short to medium term is to go back to baking from home in the next few weeks, really. In a hopefully sustainable way for me.
Yes.
So yeah, I'll be notifying customers.
Mm. And Alison's plan has worked out. She's back on the bake as well as the bike. And in fact, only last week, somebody at the Cambridge Sunday Market was saying how good her bread is.
Well, Alice Archer from the Cambridge Wine Merchants is back, and last month she was discussed the farming aspects of organic, biodynamic and natural wines. And she thought it might be interesting to talk this time about the current fashion in orange wines. There is a link.
It's a white wine, but it's a deep orange, sort of Albany colour. And the way they do this is they make a white wine as if they're making a red wine. So white wine, traditionally, you squeeze the grapes and you run the juice off the skins quite quickly, so that it's just pure juice from the inside of the grape. If you've ever peeled a grape, you'll know that the inside of a red grape is actually white, clear, it's fleshy. And so, for example, in Champagne, you can make a white wine out of red grapes. But the way you make a red wine, as we traditionally know it, is by skin contact. So you leave the skins and the pips in with the juice after you've pressed the grapes and they ferment together. And that's how you get tannin as well, which is the slightly grippy effect that you get with a lot of red wines. And so this is essentially a white wine made with skin contact. And the length of time it spends with the skins, anything from 4 days to a year, creates an orange colour and a completely different flavour profile. The reason I've brought this up in this topic is that they are always completely natural. There's no fining process, no added sulphur. It's just naturally pressed wine. And what they also often do is they actually leave it in an amphora. It's a Georgian wine technique. So this style of making wine is supposedly what they did 5,000 years ago. And in the last 10, 20 years, it's having a big trend, becoming popular in wine bars. The Ritz has two of them on by the glass. They do look very odd. I heard one critic saying, you know, when you have your first taste of orange wine, make sure you're sitting down, because it does throw you a bit. Even though it's a white wine, it's not a white wine as you know it. Mm. But you end up with flavours of sort of bruised apple. It's your kind of fruit thing going on there. Mm. And then there's honey. It's very nutty, but not quite sherried nutty, a bit like linseed oil, and also sometimes this kind of sourdough type note, you know, the smell of sourdough, sometimes something like that. Yeah, funky. But they're bold, and that makes them fantastic for food pairing, actually, as they can go with pretty much anything that you throw on a plate. Strong flavours, really, that's what they're ideal for. Also recommended with Korean food. A lot of it's fermented anyway, like kimchi. The most accessible one that I've come across is from a vineyard called Cullen, which is Western Australia, Margaret River, Perth. They make a Semillon Sauvignon blend that they then make as an orange wine as well. And you can certainly get that at the Old Bridge in Huntingdon. Importers such as Cave de Pirenne, you'll definitely be able to find orange and natural wines if you are interested. Or you can just go to the Ritz for a glass. Why not?
Saves you searching.
It does save you searching, absolutely. And then you don't have to buy the whole bottle. I think the craze in the last 20 years has come out of the globalisation of wine. The growth of wine drinking as well means that there are more and more places planting vines, and there's a lot of bland wine coming out. So these are people trying to get back to basics and just get back to their local area, which is wonderful. And so I suspect they sell a lot more near places where I'm making orange wine. So Northern Italy, you probably find loads of it all the time, but fewer people export it, mostly because it's not stable. So it's quite a difficult wine to export. Unfortunately, no one's making orange wine in Cambridgeshire or England, as far as I know. The reason why it's nice to talk about these things, we are currently in Real Wine Month, which is celebrating biodynamic, organic, natural, and orange wines and their resurgence in popularity and how they're really standing out in their own categories, almost equal in both trade and consumer terms to conventionally grown and made wine. And there's even a couple of big festivals that just celebrate these kinds of wine, yep. Both in London. There was one last weekend called Real Wine Fair, and then there's Raw, R-A-W, coming up on the 15th and 16th of May as well. In London, that's open to the public. You have to come with an open mind and be prepared to taste anything. Yeah.
Many thanks once again to Alice Archer of the Cambridge Wine Merchants. And if you'd buy tickets for that London event, just go to the website rawwine.com.
And time for the food and drink news now. And we often tweet job vacancies at Cambridge Independence. Follow us on Twitter at Cambridge105 if you want to receive them. And here are four current ones. Aromi, which this week celebrates its third birthday, by the way, is urgently seeking a kitchen assistant, a pizza chef, a supervisor and a barista. They can be full or part-time appointments. Send your CV pronto to info@aromi.co.uk.
Fitzbillies, whose new Café Cum Bakery is opening in Bridge Street in May, is looking for waiters, waitresses, baristas and counter staff. So pop in with your CV to Fitzbillies HQ in Trumpington Street.
Afternoon Teas in King Street is looking for a full-time barista. Send an email to Jo. Tell her a bit about yourself and your coffee skills, your interests and experience, and a copy of your CV. Send it to info@afternoonteas.co.uk.
And Rusty Strasser are recruiting too. They pay the living wage and the job includes setting up, taking customer orders, cash handling, serving. You may be asked to help out with behind-the-scenes preparations too. You can get the details from rustystrasser.com. Now, on to food. River Kitchen is at Novi today with a rather nice menu, and that's in Regent Street. It's from 6 to 9pm. Meanwhile, Jalan Jalan is at Calvary's Brewery in Hooper Street from now until 8.
The Old Bicycle Shop, sister to the Mill Pub and the Cambridge Brewhouse, is having soft openings at the moment, i.e. it's open, but it isn't announcing the fact. It's in Regent Street at the Hills Road end and is looking very good indeed.
Tomorrow at Novi from 9am until 4, Romano's Kitchen, and tomorrow night at the Free Press Pub in Prospect Row, it's the Rockin' Raw Chef. Do listen to the podcast of our last programme to find out about Barbara Fernandez's raw food, because it is exciting stuff.
On the 2nd of May, Kofco, the Cambridge Organic Food Company, launches its own cider, Wellham Windfall. That's from 4pm at Novi in Regent Street.
And there's a beer festival at Hudson's Ale House in Trumpington Road on the 6th and 7th of May, with 20 cask ales.
The Wandering Yak is at Hot Numbers this coming Thursday, and every Thursday as far as the eye can see, from 6 till 9pm.
And the Wandering Yak wanders over to the Blue Moon in Norfolk Street on the 12th of May. That's for a three-course Middle Eastern feast. £12 per head, 7 for 7.30 booking at Picatick.
And don't forget, from the 7th to the 22nd of May is Eat Cambridge, with scores of events all over the city. You can download the programme from the Eat Cambridge website, or get a copy from one of Cambridge's independent food outlets, or from the Tourist Information Centre.
And finally for today, the next Mill Road Summer Fair is on the 2nd of July, from 5 till 10pm, and will include a food fair in the Gwydir Street car park.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Flavour. We'll be back on the 14th of May at noon. But don't forget, you can have a listen again tomorrow morning at 7 and on the Cambridge 105 podcast page or via iTunes from early next week.
Coming up next on Cambridge 105, well, from 3 till 5, it's 105 Sport. And from 5 to 6, Tony Barnfield's Roundabout Cambridge.
And Mandy is here from 1 till 2 as well.
Of course.
But from Matt and myself, thanks very much for listening until the 14th of May, when we hope it will be a bit warmer.
Goodbye.